will know her, he said, his eyes boring into Aulën. You are not yet married. We shared the meal. From Braith's tone, insistent, demanding, full of lust, Aulën figured out what was happening here. She wanted to scream out at the ridiculousness of it. The encampment was apparently soon to be under attack, and he wanted to mount her. As soon as they passed into the tent, Braith reached for her, grabbed her by the shoulder, and closed his hand tightly on her shirt, as if to tear her clothing away. Aulën didn't doubt that he meant to do just that. Kneel, he commanded, but Shona grabbed him by the arm once more and interrupted. We are too late, she said. There is no time, and it should not be like this for her first time. Not yet. Braith stared at the older woman and simply smiled, a perfectly wicked smile. Shona seemed to wilt and backed away. Braith spun Aulën about roughly, grabbed the back waist of her trousers, and shoved her over. He didn't push her to her knees. She grabbed a nearby chair to steady herself, but tugged down her trousers. And he stabbed her from behind, and a sharp jolt of pain shot from her most private place as she felt her skin roughly tearing, her blood suddenly flowing. She tried to stifle a scream, only somewhat successfully. Braith grunted and slammed against her repeatedly, viciously. She glanced over at Shona, who had her hand up over her face and seemed near to tears, or perhaps was already crying. Braith growled like an animal and slammed his hand down on her back, and she could feel him tensing up, every muscle. She started to protest, but saw the look on Shona's face, the woman shaking her head to stop Aulën from speaking, and silently mouthing, No, no. Braith grabbed Aulën's thick black hair and yanked her head back, then growled and shook and stopped. He let go of Aulën and stepped back, and she hastily pulled up her pants, but didn't turn to face him. You are ugly, but you did well, he said. Go kill she, warrior Braith, Shona said in reassuring tones. The hero's dinner will await your return. Braith suddenly spun Aulën about and locked stares with her, and all the girl could think of was how she might get some of Shona's crystals, the green-flecked one, so that she could lift this man into the sky and drop him on his head if he came for her ever again. Coincidentally, Shona took out one of her crystals at that very moment, and she touched it to the tip of Braith's spear and whispered some enchantment Aulën did not hear. Go, warrior, she said. The man yelled with full volume, a great battle cry, then charged out of the tent, the conquering hero. No, Aulën said when he was gone. Shut up, child, Shona scolded. I will not. The words had barely left her mouth when Shona grabbed her roughly by the hair and yanked her so hard that she nearly tumbled to the floor. This is your place, Shona said. It hurt. Indeed it had, though the physical discomfort was the least of it. And Aulën didn't even know where to begin with the pain in her heart and soul. It will hurt less next time, Shona promised, her tone softening. There will be no next time. The coldness in her voice struck Aulën as profoundly as a slap. Shona actually backed away. Aulën didn't know that she could be possessed of such turmoil, such raw anger. She was afraid of what she might do if she admitted to herself what she truly wanted to do in that moment. Then they will murder you, slowly. And every man will have you before they do, Shona promised. She sighed then, and her tone became more sympathetic. It's not that bad, child. I don't like him. But surely by now you've noticed urges. For him? No. Never. That is not your choice, Shona said, still with sympathy. It is not that terrible. Pretend it is someone else behind you. Or think of the magic of Uskar, and dancing about the god crystal under a wintry night sky. Oh, if you could only come to know the god crystal, you will find pleasure, I promise. When next Breath comes for you, take your mind away, and let him be done and gone. Aulin winced, the advice reminding her painfully of that haunted look she had seen so many times in the eyes of the Umas women. It won't happen often, Shona said. Not if you join the coven, as I expect. Then you'll know the god crystal more than you'll know any man. Uskar will be your partner, and only rarely will you be called upon to satisfy Breath. The whole conversation had Aulin's belly tightening with disgust. This most intimate decision wasn't hers to make. The voices in her head and heart shouted in denial. I won't, Aulin said, but her voice was a whisper now, and Shona didn't seem to hear, or if she did, didn't seem to care. What is happening? Aulin pleaded. This is why the warriors fight to earn a witch, Shona explained. Those who do not have such a partner will go out to fight the she alone, and Isabel's face is red this night, so the demon Flossa may be about. All the weapons are already blessed, Shona nodded. But for those betrothed to a witch, there is more. The blessings of the weapon are but a minor power compared to that which we might do when the battle is near to us. I'm not betrothed. I do not want— Shona slapped Aulin so hard that she was knocked to the ground before she even realized the movement. No more, the woman warned. Te Orlik demanded it. You saw him go with Meirin, the Uskar Egin, whose word is the word of Uskar. Your arguments are ended. She presented a bundle of crystals, grasped in both her hands and holding them out to Aulin. Count to 10, girl, then wrap your hands about the symphony of Uskar. Shona closed her eyes and began to hum softly, to chant, to find the song of Uskar, Aulin knew. So curious was she in watching the older woman that she forgot to begin to count. So she just picked up at 5, then stumbled about, then just grabbed the crystals as Shona had instructed. As soon as her hands touched them, Aulin felt their pull, insistent and powerful. Shona held many crystals, and Aulin did not have time to sort through them. The only one she felt for certain was the grey-flecked wedstone crystal into which Shona was currently pouring her energies. Abruptly, shockingly so, Aulin found herself pulled outside of her body, her spirit free from corporeal constraints. Shona's spirit was there too, she understood, and it felt to Aulin as if the woman's spirit had taken her own by the hand, and insistently, as if she feared the girl might simply float away, unmoored. This sensation was so unlike anything she'd ever felt. She could fly. She could see the world around her, but it did not look real. Most everything appeared faded, as if she glimpsed it through a thick fog. But the living things in the room, Shona and Aulin's bodies, glowed comfortingly. Perhaps the most interesting, within their cupped hands she saw another light, white and beautiful, and startlingly bright. It came from one of the crystals, she knew, but not the wedstone. She would have to ask Shona about that after. After what? What was the purpose of this? Aulin wondered. She felt Shona tug at her hand. Unsure what else she could do, she allowed herself to be pulled along. Right through the side of the tent, they flew up and out of the encampment, and soon Aulin saw the ghost-like shapes of the warriors filtering through the trees. She knew immediately where the Uskar warriors were heading, to some high ground they could better defend. She and Shona hovered there for a few heartbeats, and strangely, she thought, she could still hear her heartbeat, then dived suddenly and dizzyingly directly toward a bright and living form below, directly at and then into Breyeth. The young warrior jerked at the sudden, unexpected, completely foreign feeling. He had been told what would happen, of course, but words could not describe this. This was violation. Suddenly Breyeth found that he was not alone in his own body, and his every sensibility rejected that thought. He wrestled instinctively against the intrusion, for even though he rationally understood this beneficial joining, every instinct within Breyeth screamed at him to make it stop. His resistance was futile, though, for Shona had done this many times before, and the young warrior had no experience with such magic whatsoever. Within mere moments, he knew he was defeated. Breyeth stopped struggling, and when he did, he heard a voice whispering in his ear. No, not his ear, whispering in his mind, but the voice he still recognized. Breyeth and Aulan are joined as one. And with Shona, came another voice, Aulan's voice, and it seemed on the edge of desperation, as if the young woman was as unbalanced as Breyeth. You are the weapon of Aulan's magic, Shona imparted to Breyeth. Just Aulan. I have done my part. And she was gone, Breyeth understood. Just like that. And Aulan felt Shona's departure too, he knew, for he could sense her unease. Now Shona's words, when they were heading into the tent, made sense. Had it been Aulan alone coming out to join with him, the first time for both of them, he would have reflexively rejected her, and she would not have been skilled enough to overcome that rejection. Do not fail me, young witch, he said aloud, or I will beat you bloody when the night is done. He gulped when he finished, and realized that it was Aulan's spirit making his physical form do that, making him gulp. It was so strange, and so intimate, more so perhaps than lovemaking. Even as that thought crossed his mind, he felt Aulan recoil. You don't need to speak aloud, Aulan prompted him, and though he couldn't hear the words, he felt their coldness. I know, he answered, again with his voice. He took a deep breath and glanced around, silently imploring Aulan to help him. He knew that she understood a moment later, when his vision shifted, when suddenly he could see in the starlight and red glow of the rising moon, almost as clearly as on a sunny day. He took up his spear and ran off to catch up to the battle group. She was using magic, using the crystal flecked with spots that resembled the eyes of a cat to grant him such powerful nocturnal sight. He found Ogmore near the back of the marching warriors, moving along cautiously, and easily caught up to the man. His poor friend, who had no wit to protect him and bring him great glory this night. The night is mine, Breyeth boasted, and he silently implored Aulan to offer a display. A moment later his spear tip flared to life with flames, burning with magical power. Ogmore nodded and slipped a step behind Breyeth. They came to the tree-covered ridge. It was not a dense wood, for the thin air up here kept the trees spindly and short. Te-Orlig ordered them and all the others about, setting the defensive line, and not with a moment to spare as the frenzied she scrambled up all about them. Nearly as tall as a man, the long-eared, long-nosed, grey-skinned she ran on muscled legs and fought with thick and powerful arms. They carried crude weapons, wooden spears and stone clubs, and some with thick hand-wrappings laden with flat stones or actual claws taken from a great brown bear or a hunting leopard to rake an enemy. Before Breyeth was able to sort out a target, the screams had already begun. Cries of pain, and those horrible shrieks only heard in the last moments of a man's, or a she's, life. Along with the folk of Selad Tulloch, Talmadge and Corte stared up at the great mountain that anchored the southeastern corner of Loch Bjug. They could see the distant fires here and there, and whenever the wind blew just right, they could hear some commotion.
"They're fables,"
Cote whispered to her lover. Talmadge merely shrugged. He didn't know what was happening up there, but surely something was, something exciting and likely dangerous.
"That tribe, the Uskar, they don't seem huddled,"
Cote noted. Talmadge looked all around at the folk of the tribe, most with their two-humped skulls bent back as they stared up at the mountain. Those faces, he noted, were filled with trepidation. Something was happening indeed, and it was obviously not a normal occurrence. "Say no more," he whispered quietly to Cote, letting his concern show thick in his voice. The woman squeezed his hand tighter. The comfort of that grasp overwhelmed Talmadge. Once more, he silently chided himself for not bringing this wonderful companion with him to this place he so dearly loved sooner. Up above, a light flickered and disappeared. The wind blew, and carried the unmistakable scream of a man who knew he was about to die.
"Monsters,"
Talmadge whispered under his breath, and he glanced around at the folk of the village and reminded himself that they survived because they knew. They knew this land and the dangers it concealed. Their traditions, however much they might seem rooted in superstition, kept these dangers in their thoughts and guided their actions because of those same fables he and Cote had just mocked. Talmadge reminded himself to never make light of those tales, any of those tales, even the ones for which he had never seen any evidence, ever again. When the Shee came rushing in, the lack of formation surprised Breth. He had only battled one small Shee band in his life, more of an ambush than a real battle. But all of the warriors of Uskar trained for the rare encounters with these wicked goblin creatures. One of the primary lessons for any Uskar warrior was that the Shee, as dull and primitive as they might be, knew how to fight in formation, and with devious tactics. Thus, Raeth could hardly believe the first wave of Shee charging up the ridge. Haphazard, with no discernible line, most continued looking back over their shoulders instead of confronting the Uskar warriors who stood to destroy them. And destroy them the Uskar did. Down the goblins went, one after another, and within heartbeats, the warriors were fighting with each other over who could get the next kill. Off to the far side, Breath got none, and he was too surprised to even focus his complaints.
"They did not come for us," he heard in his head,
an astute observation from Aulan, he thought.
"They are in flight."
Breath nodded, for as he watched the unfolding massacre with that thought in mind, it all made sense. He knew then that if he wanted to claim some glory this red-tinged night, he would have to actively find some she to kill. "Stay close to the others," he instructed Agmor, who was immediately to his left. "Where are you going?" Agmor demanded.
"They are all about. I go to scout the flank," Breath answered.
And he ran away. His bounding steps took him farther and faster than he intended, each stride covering the ground that would normally take two. It was Aulan, he realized, channeling the levitational magic as he went. So he moved lightly, silently, and with great speed. Just down to the left lay a second ridge, rocky and with a line of short pines atop it. Rounding the top of that line of trees, Breath found his she. A small group streaming through a bowl-shaped lee of deep grasses just to the side of the battle.
"Be with me," he whispered aloud, imploring Aulan.
In Breath charged, spear presented. He shot the nearest she down just as it turned, startled, to face him, a bolt of lightning sizzling from his spear tip and throwing the monster aside, where it tumbled to the ground and twitched uncontrollably. On the Uskar warrior rushed, roaring his battle cry. He sent his spear slashing to the side, taking a she's club with it, and lighting its scraggly hair with the flames dancing on his weapon's tip in the same movement. He brought the spear back fast, the monster trying to counter with its club. The distraction caused by the creature's burning hair cost the she dearly. Its club came in almost half-heartedly against Braith's side as he pressed in, as his spear tip burrowed into the monster's chest. The weapon tip exploded into flame, and the ugly she squealed and fell dead before Braith had even extracted his deadly magical weapon. He ran right over the fallen monster, noting the boiling blood bubbling from the hole in its chest.
"Flames!" he growled at Aulan,
nearing three more of the beasts, who formed a semicircle to entice him in. And in Braith went, sweeping his spear right to left, the flames roaring ahead of the weapon, igniting hair and filthy clothing, lighting the branches of the trees that framed the small lee. Braith stabbed and roared. Another she fell, stuck through the chest. A second tried to run away, but ploughed into a low-hanging bough that was fully engulfed, and so the creature, too, became fully engulfed in biting magical fire as it tumbled down. The third staggered away, not badly hurt, not burning brightly, but clearly too terrified to confront this mighty Uskar death dealer. Braith started after, but stopped abruptly as he caught the motion of a spinning weapon out of the corner of his eye. He cried out and threw himself to the side, but not fast enough. The axe buried into his left shoulder, driving him backward. "Pull it out," he heard in his head. "Remove it, quickly." He reached for the axe, still backpedaling, and a good thing too. Out through the trees came a line of she, advancing in formation. Braith tried to keep his sensibilities against the spinning world. He tried to hold his spear in his left hand, his trembling right hand reaching for the embedded axe. He grasped it, grimacing in agony, thinking there was no way he could find the strength to tear it out of his shoulder. "Back! Back! Back!" Aulan screamed in his mind, and then, as if to accentuate her point, Braith floated off the ground and was hit with a gust of wind that sent him flying backward all the way to the tree line back at the top of the rocky ridge. And in the windy jerk that began the flight, Braith's hand came forward, holding the bloody axe. He looked to his shoulder as he skidded down, saw the blood pouring forth, felt the waves of agony and dizziness, and knew he would collapse onto the ground, to be murdered by the advancing she. More than the she had noticed Braith's glorious exploits. From just northeast of the rocky ridge's tree line, back and higher up the mountain, Te-Oleg watched the display of magic with his mouth hanging open. He knew where Braith was getting that power. Power he could not match because the Uskar-Regin, as agreed, had broken her tie to him after magically assisting him with levitation so that he could quickly form the Uskar line. Meren did not want to be intimately tied to Te-Oleg any more than he wanted that haggard old witch joining him in spirit or in body. But now, he watched Braith, watched the pulse of fire light up she and trees alike, watched him fly back to safety to recover, and from a wound that should have ended his fighting this night. Aulan. It was Aulan, Elara's daughter, Braith's wife. What glories this man would know with this kind of power joining with him. Glories to outshine Te-Oleg, even. Te-Oleg clamped his mouth shut, teeth grinding, as he watched the scene in the lee beside the main battle. Another was watching too, though not with physical eyes, and from behind the scrambling she, for it had been the cause of the goblin's flight this night. The blood moon had risen, and so the fossa had come forth, and now the song, the interminable, horrid vibration of magic, twanged discordantly at its life energy, insulting it, paining it, demanding a response. It wasn't as bad as that night a few weeks before, but the pulse of pain was strong, so strong. And this time, the fossa was out under the red sky. This night, the fossa could put an end to it.
Breath slumped down, almost to one knee, but before he got there, a wave of healing washed through him. The bleeding stopped, the skin knitted, and the strength in his left arm returned almost immediately. The young warrior straightened to face the line of Shi coming toward him, marching in a coordinated and tactical manner.
"Be with me," he muttered to Aulan, and he was not afraid. He would win here, and would slay a dozen more of these monsters. He would claim more kills this night than the rest of the Uskar warriors combined.
Still, Braith knew that even with Aulan's help, this was going to be difficult, and he fully expected he'd be feeling the bite of several more brutal wounds before the fight was ended. He could defeat a Shi one-on-one, but he was woefully outnumbered here. But then, down to the left, a Shi squealed and disappeared into the tall grass. Catching it out of the corner of his eye, Braith couldn't figure out what had happened. Was it a ruse? A maneuver for the monster to get into the deep grass to conceal its advance? Had a spear hit it? As Braith stood there, pondering, the next Shi went flipping over backward and down into the grass, again screaming, and the third in line cried out and started to run before it too disappeared.
"Aulan?"
Braith asked in his thoughts. She didn't answer directly, but he understood from her jumbled thoughts that she was as confused as he. Another Shi went down, and Braith caught the movement across a bare patch of ground, a weasel-like black form, but huge, flashing across the patch, into the grass on the other side. There, another Shi was brought down, and another went flying. And Braith understood.
"The Fossa!"
he gasped, barely able to breathe. And the grass began shaking as the creature, low to the ground, streaked for him like a coming gale. He couldn't hope to dodge or flee. But into the air went Braith, high and straight up, and then he felt a wind at his back, hurling him forward across the lea. Up from the grass leapt the Fossa, impossibly high, its red eyes burning with inner demonic flames, staring at him hatefully, its open maw showing gleaming fangs and biting at his feet. And just missing, the creature landed and sprang right back up, but Braith was higher now, up in the air beyond its reach.
"Aim your spear,"
he heard in his mind, and he lifted the weapon as if to throw.
"No, just point it,"
Aulan telepathically implored him, and he did, and a blast of lightning erupted from the tip, shooting down at the demon Fossa. The bolt thundered in, shaking the ground, burning the grasses, and when the light diminished enough for Braith to see, he noted the Fossa, seemingly unhurt, and leaping again for him, higher this time.
"Kill it!"
he cried to Aulan, aiming the spear tip to follow the black creature's descent. Another bolt shot forth and struck the creature in midair, but it did not throw the Fossa aside, not at all. It seemed instead to simply shoot into the thing, or was absorbed by it. As the Fossa set back down, its eyes burned the brighter. Another burst of wind hit Braith, launching him along toward the distant trees. On the ground the Fossa pursued, red eyes locked upon its prey. Te Orlik could barely sort out what he was seeing in the small meadow before him. The Shi fell. The Shi fled. And Braith flew into the air with the Fossa snapping wildly at his feet. It was all too unexpected and crazy. The lesser man, or perhaps a wiser one, would have fled immediately, run back to the Uskar lines and ordered a fast retreat to the encampment, and the thought did cross Te Orlik's mind. But there the sensible notion bumped against the man's determination and his anger. He was watching before him, both literally and figuratively, the rise of young Braith, who, with the help from his betrothed, would surely eclipse his glory. Te Orlik could not allow that. The young warrior flew toward the distant tree line,
but reversed course and soared back toward the nearer rocky ridge, just down to the left from Te'olik. Coming, too, was the Fossa, leaping now and then at the warrior, whose spear responded with strokes of ineffective lightning.
Closer they came. The demon focused full on the warrior, on Breyth, who was being held up by Aulën through their magical connection. Te'olik was hardly aware of the movement as his hand went to his belt, and he was barely conscious of the small and smooth gemstone rolling between his fingers. He felt the power of the sunstone then, and before he could talk himself out of it, before he could really consider the implications, he sent forth the stone's enchantment. A burst of anti-magic. Flying Breyth became falling Breyth, the man plummeting right into a pine tree, shattering a branch, and probably some of his own bones, Te'olik thought, given the grunt and wail coming out of there. What had he done? For all of his power and brutality, Te'olik winced and turned away as the black form of the Fossa leaped into the pine at the same point where Breyth had disappeared. The tree shook, branches shattered, and out the bottom they all fell. And out from under the tree came the Fossa, the demon monster of Fyrrokspuer, running up the slope with a broken man hanging from its jaws, much of Breyth dragging along on the ground beside the running monster. Right for Te'olik it came. He couldn't dodge, couldn't flee. How feeble his weapon seemed against the bared power of the demon. He wished then that he had forced Meron to remain with him in spirit. But even that, he realized, would not be enough. He braced as the Fossa charged in, but he might as well have been trying to stop an avalanche. He was hurled aside by the impact, and rolled desperately, trying to come around and bring his spear into line, for whatever good it might do. 24. The Realm of Insubstantial. Back in the Uskar camp, Aulën's corporeal form let out a whimper in surprise as her magic failed her, as she felt her malachite and moonstone connection so suddenly severed. She watched the descent through Breath's eyes, and cried out again with the branches shattering all about her as the man tumbled through. She felt Breath's pain, and tried to focus on the vibrations of the wedstone to send him healing. The young woman hesitated. She felt the barrier between her magic and Breyth. Perhaps she could have broken through that barrier, whatever it was, and given him a chance. But Aulën remembered what he had done to her. How he had taken her. She hesitated. She cried out again, gripped by terror, as she saw the horrible demon leaping at her. No, not at her, she realized, but at Breyth, out there in the field. The beast bit in with those murderous jaws. Aulën started to call to the whetstone, thinking that she must heal the man at once. But then she simply screamed again, her thoughts spinning. She felt her life energy fluctuating, splintering. She knew that the Fossa had bitten Breyth's flesh, yes, but somehow, some way, it was also biting at Aulën's very spirit, breaking her apart, sending shards of agony through the flow of energy that sustained her life and magic. She felt her life force being drawn out of her. She had an idea, a desperate idea. If she had paused to think about it, the absurdity would have given her pause. Aulën shifted all of her focus to the vibrations of the wedstone. She felt the Fossa's power stutter, as if the demon was shivering, and Aulën knew hope. But then there came a flash, an intrusion, as if something or someone else had leaped into the battle. And then, blackness, sudden emptiness. Aulën thought she was dead. Thought that she had left the world behind so suddenly, and was tumbling, anchorless. She could not find her bearings. She was high above the world, and yet she was not in the world. Everything was tinted red, like the moon,
Isabel's bloody face.
And it was so distant.
And she was lost.
Was this death?
Breyth lay upon the stones, unmoving, his body tangled, his guts exposed. Beside him, the demon Fossa leaped all about, seeming confused. More than that, it seemed hurt, truly hurt. Its front shoulder, where it had collided with Te Oleg, was smoking and bubbling. It dropped its face to the ground, snuffling, head swiveling all about. Searching.
Te Oleg watched the spectacle curiously. Was the creature blind?
It had cut down the line of Shi with devastating efficiency, had tracked the movements of Breyth up in the air unerringly, and so completely that it had flown into the tree exactly behind the man. But now it seemed confused, even nervous, and seemed as if it could not see Te Oleg, with whom it had just collided. And it was hurt worse than he, much worse. The lightning hadn't slowed it or even stung it, but the collision with Te Oleg... No, he realized. The collision with his magic had clearly hurt the creature. What did it mean? The man was too shaken to fully sort it out. He wanted to slide farther away, but feared making any noise. He didn't want to engage this monster. Not now. Not alone. He clenched his fingers tighter and felt the magic of the small and round gemstone he held in his hand, the sunstone. He felt the tiny, sharp flecks of amethyst that were embedded in the stone. He glanced at it, then back to the fossa. He had been calling upon the magic when the creature had charged at him. No, not at him, but had charged in his direction. Oblivious to him, perhaps. He focused and pressed, trying to keep the anti-magic in effect now, as though his life depended on it. The fossa couldn't locate him. Te Oleg was not well versed in the ways of Uskar. He had come upon this curious gem quite unexpectedly years ago, and had told none of the witches, nor anyone else, about it. He had learned long ago how to use it to interrupt the magic of the witches, if only briefly. Now he had learned something else about the curious stone, it seemed. Something that might save his life. Up above him, the fossa clamped its jaws upon Breyth once more, and began its run up the side of the mountain, the weight of the near-dead man not even slowing the powerful monster. Down below, Te Oleg dared to breathe again. On sudden instinct, he sent a burst of his magic at the fleeing demon. It staggered and stumbled. Te Oleg glanced down at the gemstone, his eyes sparkling. She was lost, and floating in empty air, leaving the world, leaving life itself. She had no idea of where Breyth had gone, or if he was still alive. She told herself that she didn't care. She knew it to be a lie, though, for deep inside she did care, and she wanted Breyth to be dead. She remembered the murderous bite of the demon Fossa, and expected that her desire would be granted. Guilt accompanied that notion, but Alan found that the thought of the man's potentially horrible death did not trouble her as much as it would have earlier that same evening. And so she let it go. Instead, Alan wondered if she was still alive. All about her was dark, red and black, a world of silhouettes and shadows, with no sense of solidity or warmth, no sense of anything at all. Silent, still, empty, dead. But then, in the midst of the emptiness, there came a flash of color, green and bright. A flash of light that beckoned to her. Alan willed herself toward the tiny speck of light, flew faster and faster, though she could hear no wind, and feel no breeze, or even any sensation of movement. She just saw the light, the only speck of brightness and warmth in the midst of the shadows. It grew, now a beacon. It blinded her,
but that did not deter her.
No. She flew for it desperately, out of options, almost out of hope.
She passed through it, a sudden, lightning-like shock, and she shuddered and felt the corporeal movement of her own body. There she sat, groaning, whimpering, trying to sort out thoughts that would not straighten. She tried to remember her name, thought of Uskar, of the cave, and, to her surprise, of Badlan. Finally she found some solidity, some sense of the life she had known. She felt and saw her hands trembling. A twitch kept knocking her head to the side involuntarily. Her life force continued to crackle and jolt, and for a long while would not steady. A mewling to the side caught her notice and grounded her, surprised, confused. Aulan at last blinked open her eyes to find herself sitting in Shona's tent. Her crystals lay on the floor before her, and instinctively she reached for them, but she stopped before her hand touched the pile, noticing that there beside her sat Shona. Aulan called to her. The woman didn't seem to hear, didn't react at all to Aulan, but she, too, was shaking and whimpering softly. Shona?
Aulan said curiously, reaching for her. She realized then that Shona was holding crystals of her own, and from the look on her face, the witch was deeply into them, was entranced in the song of Uskar. Aulan pulled her hand back and thought again of her brief encounter with the Fossa, and then realized the truth of her disengagement.
Shona!
She cried. The woman had come to her in her joining with Breyth. The woman, her mentor, had thrown Aulan aside and out of the monster's magical grasp. Shona didn't answer, but she did yelp a bit, and her face scrunched as if in pain. She was still there, Aulan knew. Shona had rejoined Breyth, and so now was doing battle with the Fossa. Aulan had to get her, to help her. She reached for the symphony of crystals, unsure of how to even begin. She should start with the whetstone, she supposed, to escape her mortal coil. Shona cried out, screaming in sudden agony and horror. Aulan grabbed hard at the magical shards Shona grasped. She yanked the woman's hands apart and slapped the crystals from her hand, then pulled the former witch so that her face was very near, and began screaming for Shona to come back to her. The older woman began to tremble and gasp. Her eyelids fluttered, but she did not open her eyes for any length of time, and in those brief moments when Aulan could see her orbs, they seemed unfocused, as if Shona was looking far, far away. The older woman's lips moved, but no understandable sounds came forth. Just grunts and gasps and empty breaths. By the time a very shaken Te Orlig stumbled back beyond the rocky ridge to rejoin his warriors, the original fight had all but ended. A handful of Uskar had been wounded, but only one, seriously, and the ground about them was littered with the corpses of 10 she. "Where is Breyth?" Agmor asked, the moment he rejoined Te Orlig at the right end of the line. Te Orlig shook his head, his expression grim, and that elicited a response the Uskar Lauch did not expect.
"What did you do?" Agmor asked in a low voice.
Te Orlig stared at him in disbelief, his eyes boring into the young man's until Agmor had to look away. Te Orlig let his gaze slip down then, to note that Agmor's hands were clenched tightly upon his spear. Not taking any chances, Te Orlig dropped his own spear and stepped in closer suddenly, then grabbed Agmor's spear mid-shaft with his left hand and sent his right up under the man's jaw, grabbing hard. Agmor brought his own hand up to claw at Te Orlig's wrist and tug as he tried to squirm away, but he could not break the mighty warrior's grasp. Te Orlig knew that he had the attention of the other tribesmen, all bristling nervously, but he didn't care. With frightening strength, he yanked Agmor around and locked him in place, forcing the man to look up the mountainside. Agmor struggled futilely and grunted in protest against the painful clench, but then, all of a sudden, the man just stopped and slumped, and his grunt became a gulp. For up there, across a clear expanse on a higher mountain spur, he noted the black form moving swiftly and low to the ground, dragging something. Something he knew to be his friend. Te Oleg roughly shoved him back and retrieved his spear, then called to the others, "Form! Form! She to the right!" Indeed, the fight wasn't over, as the group that had been chased off by the fossa had now returned, with reinforcements. "Bend the line," Te Oleg ordered, motioning for half a dozen warriors to come up above him on the mountain, forming a right angle to the main line, which he anchored. The rest of the Shi came on then, once more, from their original direction. Having had time to shake off the initial shock of the Uskar ambush, and no longer having to worry about the fossa, the Shi moved against the tribesmen in force, a straight line of goblin killers with all flanks supported.
"Crouch! Hold!" Te Oleg commanded.
He did a quick count. He had more than 30 warriors, still able to fight, against almost twice that number of Shi. But they held the higher ground, except on this flank, where they were on even footing with their enemies. He could have called for a retreat, but that would have sealed the doom of at least one of his warriors. He had already lost one. No more. The Shi charge up the mountainside ended abruptly in a furious barrage of lightning and fire as Uskar spear tips exploded against the front ranks.
"Hold this angle,"
Te Oleg told Ogmore, yanking him into position of the two wings of their line.
"For your life and honor."
Te Oleg ran, straight up the mountainside, tapping each man on the back as he passed, telling them to hold fast. When he got to the last man, he reiterated that call. Then to the surprise of them all, and to the 10 Shi coming in, the mighty warrior leapt out from the ranks back toward the rocky ridge line to meet the charge alone. He swept his spear across, left to right, let go with his left hand as it flew out wide until the shaft locked against his lower back, stopping the swing cold. A sudden twist sent the weapon sweeping back the other way at belt level, and with such power that it slapped away the Shi weapons and forced the monsters back. Te Oleg lifted his arm as the spear came around, sending it into a spin over his head. Once and then again, and with each sweep the man moved up higher, down lower, changing his angle, shifting his hips, forcing the Shi to react. Te Oleg let go of his spear in the sweep, catching it mid-shaft in his left hand, and turning back for a sudden thrust that put the tip into a Shi's chest, releasing a burst of flames a heartbeat later. Back across swept the spear, a mirror image of the first maneuver, with Te Oleg's left hand going out wide this time, until the spear's shaft locked against his lower back, then sweeping left to right once more, and up over his head and around again. Behind that second sweep came a Shi, club swinging hard to smash Te Oleg in the chest. And he took it, he managed to keep his wits while shrugging off the explosion of pain, and turned back with sudden fury and force, pivoting around the creature and shoving it with all his strength to send it tumbling back toward his line of warriors. They leapt upon the creature, Ogmore leading, all stabbing furiously, and then retreating to their defensive positions once more. Te Oleg launched a ferocious dance, jumping and swinging, unconcerned about actually scoring any hits. He was baiting the enemies, nothing more. He taunted and spat, and he kicked at the Shi he had stabbed as it squirmed on the ground, garnering the attention of the Shi and gradually moving back a step, then another.
"Ogmore," he called, a warning.
Then he stopped suddenly, and the Shi leapt at him as one, spears and clubs leading. But Te Oleg called upon the green flecks in the weapon Meron had blessed, and with a sudden twitch, leapt backward, the levitation strengthening his spring. He landed right before his line, the Shi bearing in on him, and fell as he touched down.
"Throw!"
Ogmor appropriately commanded, and his and a half-dozen other spears flew out into the faces of the charging Shi. These were followed by seven warriors, each drawing knives, throwing punches, kicking, tackling, grabbing for fallen weapons. Uskar spear and Shi club, anything to inflict pain. Moments later, Teolik was back among them, rushing between grappling Uskar, cracking one Shi hard against the head with the butt of his spear as he passed. Then out he slid, down low on one knee, and out he stabbed with all his might the other way, out and up, and he caught a Shi in the belly and drove upward, rising to his feet with a roar, lifting the squealing and squirming creature up before him, then up above him. With a heave, Teolig sent the skewered Shi flying away, back down the mountainside, and back behind him, so that it crashed into its companions battling the Uskar line below. Teolig heard the cheers from his lower line, and the surprised screams of the Shi, but he didn't let it divert his attention. He turned back the other way, sliding the butt of his spear shaft out as he went to parry aside a Shi's spear. He turned all the way under it as he lifted it, putting his back to the monster. And before it could take advantage of that, it got a face full of Teolig's flying elbow, once and again. Down it went, and around came Teolig, his spear spinning in his hands, twirling up high, changing its angle perfectly, so that when he again faced the fallen Shi, he could stab straight down, impaling it in the chest. He ripped it right out again, though, and flung himself left and down low, sweeping the spear across to take the feet out of another charging Shi. Up he went to face yet another. A thrust drove it back, and on the reaction, Teolig slid the shaft back again and stabbed it down several times, butt-end first, into the face of the Shi he had tripped. Then, as he reset his balance to meet the one he had driven back with the thrust, he stomped down upon the neck of that tripped and now dazed enemy with bone-crunching force. The Shi before him skidded to a stop and fell back, wanting no part of this wild warrior. With the reprieve, Teolig glanced left and right, all about, and took a quick measure. This end of the line had routed the Shi that had come over the rocky ridge. Ogmor and the other six were bloody, but still up for a fight, which was more than could be said for the remaining Shi.
"Form!" Teolig shouted. "Swing the door!"
The warriors disengaged and finished their kills, gathered their weapons quickly.
"Ogmor, hinge!" Teolig demanded,
and Ogmor scrambled back to his original position at the right end of the main forward line. Teolig centered the other seven as they charged around the pivoting Ogmor, sweeping down to drive hard into the left flank of the main body of Shi. Teolig scored only one more kill. Shortly after the swinging maneuver, the Shi broke ranks and fled as their flank collapsed. A younger Teolig would have ordered pursuit and chased the Shi halfway down the mountain to satiate his bloodlust. But he understood the precipitating events of this bloody night. The Shi had not come to raid the Uskar camp. It was entirely an accident that they had come this way at all, and so, routed here, they would not return. A dozen Uskar warriors needed tending, himself included. Every breath he drew pained him greatly against the ribs the Shi's club had cracked. The Uskar didn't even bother to kill those Shi lying wounded on the ground. They gathered up their wounded and formed a defensive retreat for camp. Teolig kept Ogmor with him at the back of that formation, the two watching for any signs of enemies. And both of them glancing repeatedly up the mountainside, to where the demon Fossa had gone. To where dead Breyth had been dragged. Ogmor understood that he had lost his best friend. Teolig believed he had just gained a powerful wife. 25. When the Red Moon Set. How sweet tasted the man flesh! How satisfying to drink the blood! In the dark, in the bone-filled pit, The Fossa feasted on the corpse of Braith.
But this was just the dessert of its meal this day.
For the Fossa had feasted on that incessant song, had bitten the magic of the mountains, and had devoured it. The human had thrown lightning at the creature, but lightning couldn't hurt the Fossa. No magical evocations could weaken this creature. Not in the red light of the blood moon. No, the lightning had only made the Fossa stronger, had only given it energy and sustenance. And the deeper bite the Fossa had inflicted on the purveyor of that magic was not physical. The sorceress had come against the demon in the realm of the spirit, and in that realm the demon ate more hungrily, and each bite fed it more fully than man flesh ever could. The demon had reveled in the groans and screams of this man it now consumed, but the silent screams of the magic user, singing her songs to her false god, rang sweeter still. The Fossa lifted its bloody face and looked up the pit, though of course it could see little in the darkness. But in its mind, the demon saw past the dark stones, back to the open air it had known this night, under the calming red glow of the full moon. Yes, that sweet full moon, red and serene, breaking the maddening sound of magic that hummed continually in this mountain. How fine the freedom! How wonderful the ability to fight back against that vicious hum! The Fossa held the pose for just a moment, savoring the memory of the open air. Then it plunged its toothy maw down hard on the body, bouncing it among the bones, chewing the bones, crunching ribs and breaking through. When it came back up from the corpse, Braith's torn heart hung out the side of its mouth. "They think it the she," Talmadge told Chote after the moon had set. The folk of Selat Tolloch back out and about, many simply too excited by the events of that night to find sleep. "She? Mountain goblins," he explained. "Vicious brutes, though. Bigger than the ones we see back east, but, thankfully, just as rarely seen. The folk believe we may have witnessed a battle up on the mountainside. She against Uskar. Will they send scouts?" "No," Talmadge replied suddenly, and more forcefully than he had intended. "No," he said again, more calmly. "The tribes of Lochbeag do not go up the mountain. Not ever. They see the Uskar as demons in human form. That seems foolish."
"You've never met an Uskar."
"Have you?"
"I've seen the aftermath of their raids and heard the laments of encounters. That's enough to keep me near the lake."
Cote took a moment to digest all of that. She looked up the dark mountain and let her gaze linger there, and didn't hide the intrigue on her face.
"This is a dangerous land," she said. "Monsters in the lake, big lizards that like to eat the flesh of men, demon men on the mountain, goblins. I wonder why anyone stays.
This is their home, the only one they've ever known, and not without its charm," Talmadge answered.
"Charming enough to keep you coming here, or profitable enough?"
Talmadge laughed.
"Both."
"And enough for you to keep it Talmadge's secret?"
He looked at her curiously, and shook his head to show that he knew where this was heading, and it was a discussion they had already had. But Chote simply smiled back and sidled up to him, draping her arms about his neck.
"Or was it just me?"
she asked in a husky voice.
"Were you afraid that I'd steal your secret? Your profits?"
"I care nothing for that."
"What does Talmadge care about?"
"You."
The exciting events of the night seemed far away then, as more pressing needs rose between the lovers. Cote backed up, holding him close every step, then disappeared under the flap of their tent, Talmadge right behind. She put a finger against his pursed lips to hold him back for a moment.
"Will you be taking me back to this place?"
she asked, lying beside him.
"Do we even have to leave?" The question hit Khorte by surprise, but she didn't say no. She didn't say another word, in fact, until the sun was long up the next morning. The blood moon hung low in the western sky when the Uskar warriors limped back into their encampment, many bleeding. Te Olig grimaced with every breath.